of all, thank you, Thomas and Hans, for organizing this session. It's a great pleasure to be here today. There's an awful lot of interesting problems in energy markets that we've heard about in the first hour. I'm not proposing to solve all of them in the second hour. I'd like to show you just some of the things that we've been working on. And in particular, I want to show you some models for optimal control of real generation and, I shouldn't really say generation there, I should say real energy assets. I always tell my students the last thing you write in any piece of work is the abstract, but of course when you're giving a conference talk that procedure is inverted and the abstract is the first thing you write, and then you realize that wasn't quite the order you wanted to put it in. So my apologies for that. We want to view the show, I guess. All right. So this particular piece of work, my collaborators were Matt Thompson, who was my PhD student at the time, and Henning Rasmussen, who was Matt's co-supervisor at the time, and Peter Vincent and other folks at OPG gave us a lot of practical insights into some of these problems. And we got some funding from MITAC, NSERC, OPG, and DIDEX Research and Capital. I'd like to begin by talking about a problem that isn't directly to do with electricity. It's got to do with natural gas storage. And the reason why I've chosen to look at natural gas storage first is natural gas, Hans had this great image of the financial engineering hammer banging through the wall. Financial math works really well for things like stocks that you can store. When I say a stock, I mean a share or a bond. Things that you can store, you can sell to people later, and that allows a big machinery of ideas to come into play. We heard how non-storable electricity was, and natural gas is sort of close to electricity and non-storability, but not quite as out there, not quite as extreme. It's a little bit more like a financial asset. So it's the sort of natural starting place, I think, in hindsight. This was the last problem that we studied in this stream of ideas, but it's the natural starting place to begin a look at bringing financial engineering techniques to some of these real engineering facilities in the presence of real power markets. Once I've talked about natural gas storage, and I'll go through in a fair bit of detail how all the machinery works, and if anyone's interested in even more detail, they can feel free to contact me, and I'll send you what's still a preprint on this. Then I'll talk about how the same ideas apply with pump storage facilities and thermal power plants, given a similar model for electricity prices. If time permits, I'll tell you a little bit about work that another former PhD student of mine, Lindsay Anderson, and I have done on another way of modeling electricity prices, which is closer to the stack-based models that that Peter was talking about earlier. I don't imagine time will permit, and so I invite everyone who's coming to the CORES meeting in Montreal to come to my talk there, where we'll talk more about it. Okay, here's an outdated price time series of Henry Hub natural gas prices, and I guess what's jumping out at you there is the price sort of has some ups and some downs, and if you're looking at this with eyes of greed, what you might suggest, it would be a really good idea, it would be nice if you could buy the gas when it was here on day 599 and wait one day and sell it up here on day 600. And that would be a really nice way to make some money. And the reason in a nutshell is the reason why standard financial markets don't usually work this way. Because if this were a stock price, the guys who bought it yesterday at, $3 would say, great, I'll sell it for $12. I quadrupled my money in one day. I'm out, right? Okay, so why doesn't that happen in natural gas? It's because of the lack of storability that has already been discussed today. Natural gas is extracted from the earth in wells. It gets put onto pipelines and gets shipped. Let's use a Canadian example from the question. No, this is spot. Using a Canadian example, it's extracted from the earth in gas wells in the Western Canadian Basin. It's put on pipelines, and maybe it sort of emerges in Ontario and Sarnia someplace and gets turned into petrochemicals. Okay, but it's coming on the pipeline, and it's coming, and you better be ready to use it when it arrives, because you can't really store it on the pipeline. You can store it a little bit more than you can store electrons on a transmission line, but it's the same kind of idea. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to... Oh, I guess I sort of the wrong order there. We're going to try and store the gas, and this is done, in underground facilities. And so the gas comes in, you pump it underground, and then you can release it later when it's worth more. So there's a bunch of different ways in which natural gas storage facilities can work. The one that's relevant in an Ontario setting is salt caverns. There's some salt domes in Lambton County, kind of near Sarnia, which is convenient, where you can pump gas into the salt. So this is a classic salt dome, if anyone's taking a geology class. Hydrocarbons are often trapped under salt domes, and once the hydrocarbons have been removed from the storage facility, from this deposit, it can then be used as a storage facility. And essentially, it works. The model we're going to use is like a big balloon. You blow the gas into the balloon, the pressure rises, and then you release the gas from the balloon when you want to. Okay. So that's oversimplified engineering in a huge way, but just to give you a flavor for what's going on. The approach that we're going to take is to, if anyone's read Merton's book, Finance in Continuous Time, he lays out a approach to portfolio optimization for portfolios of stocks and bonds, which we're going to carry over directly to this new problem, okay? Except instead of incorporating details of financial portfolios, we're going to incorporate some engineering details, which is going to make the mathematics a little bit harder, and I apologize for the misordering. Okay, so I want to tell you a little bit more about how these gas facilities work. And the first thing you've seen there, it's been a long time since high school, for me at least, but perhaps, I mean, everybody probably remembers that's the ideal gas law, right? And so that's the mathematical shorthand for saying we're going to model this thing as a big balloon. So the thing you need to know about natural gas facilities is there's a certain amount of gas that you have to store in them, called the base gas, and that's essentially just to keep the pressure high enough that things don't start breaking down. And then from that base gas, you can inject and withdraw a wedge of gas called the working gas capacity. This can happen only at certain rates. You can inject it at a certain rate, or actually, I guess you can extract it at a given rate, which is what I'm talking about here. And that rate's going to depend on how full the facility is. If the facility is very full, the pressure in the balloon or the underground formation will be high, and you'll be able to extract the gas relatively quickly, just like the air coming out of a balloon when it's really full will be scooting out really quickly at first. Injection capacity has the same kind of effect. You can inject it at certain rates, which depend on many things, including the level of gas in the facility. This cycling is essentially a way of expressing the deliverability and the injection capacity as one number, and it tells you basically how many times you can put all the gas in and take all the gas out over the course of a year. Many gas storage facilities, you can only do it once in a year. Salt caverns are a little bit better. You can put gas in and out as many as sort of five times a year. And HDMC stands for high deliverability multiple cycling. And the multiple cycling just means you can put it in and out multiple times a year. Some of these other gas storage facilities are really only useful for balancing winter and summer demand for natural gas. This hopefully is a little bit useful for some other things as well. Okay, and then there's some other details you got to worry about. There can be seepage into the reservoir, that's a loss, and it's going to cost you, you're going to have to burn some gas to run the pumps to pump and release the gas. So that's another sort of deadweight cost in the process. Okay, so then go ahead and put a lot of mathematical formalism down. The things that really matter are that P is going to denote our price process. I is going to denote the total amount of gas we already have stored. C is going to be our control variable, which is how much gas we're either injecting, and if we're injecting it, we're going to use the convention that it's positive, or that should say actually releasing, in which case the value of C is negative. And all these other things are just maximum and minimum values of these things are kind of constraints. And there's the loss function, which deals with the seepage and the pump costs. Okay, so this is not anything new. This is Merton's stochastic. This is Merton's financial approach to the financial portfolio optimization problem. And it wasn't even new when Merton did it. It's really just Bellman's principle stochastic optimal control that I'm going to be showing you now. So if anybody knows that already, just bear with me. What we're putting in here is we're saying we want to maximize the total money we make from this facility. And the total in a suitably time discounted way, so there's the time discount rate. C times P is going to be the amount of money we get if we're pumping gas out, because then C is positive, and the amount of money we have to expend if we're pumping gas in, because C is negative. And this loss rate is always going to work against us. Okay? So that's what we want to control. We want to find the optimal control depending on these variables. That makes that objective function as big as possible. Okay, now this is where, well, okay, oh well, yeah. And then there's some constraints that we need to worry about. We can't, C has to be between a maximum and minimum level. We can't deliver faster than or release, we can't inject or deliver faster or than a certain rate. And there's going to be also some constraints on the how full and how empty the reservoir can be. The rate, the level in the reservoir is going to depend on how much we're pumping and how much we're losing. And we're going to make a very simple formulation for the natural gas price process. We're going to assume it's a stochastic differential equation with this is going to be a mean reversion term, this is going to be a volatility term, and it's going to allow for the possibility of some jumps. Okay, so these are Poisson jumps. And with all that stuff in, we want to find the optimal control, and we want to find the corresponding value of the facility when the price is P, the level is, that should be I, and the injection rate is C. Okay, so the way we do that is the standard Bellman principle trick, where we split that whole integral into two pieces. The first delta t seconds of the integral, and then the rest of it. And then the rest of it, we can just reformulate back as the original function itself. And we're going to move this towards a Bellman's equation. We're going to use Itô's lemma on the dps that we get. Where's my... the stochastic differential equation is going to obey Itô's lemma. That's sort of standard financial engineering methodology that I'm trying to bang through the wall here. And what Itô's lemma essentially is it's the way of doing, differential if you have a white noise term. And it keeps you honest in keeping all the terms of order dt properly. Okay. So we expand that previous thing in basically a Taylor series. We throw out all terms of higher order than dt. We cancel things across, and v's across to get a zero on one side. And we end up with something that's starting to look like a partial differential equation. Okay? And then we have to remember we're finding the maximum, we're maximizing this for all C. C only participates in a certain number of terms. That gives us a fairly compact way of finding the optimal control at any point. Once we've found that optimal control, we can put it back in the equation, and we end up with that really a PIDE, partial integral differential equation. These expectations are essentially integrals, exact properties of which depend on the form of the Poisson process. Yeah, so the jump size is going to be, is still buried in the expectation there. Well, I can have jumps of any size. I did make that assumption, but you can't see it. You can't see it yet. It's buried. I made exactly that assumption, but that's buried in the expectation. Yep. Okay, so that leads you to that partial integral differential equation. We have a... You always know it's a financial math talk when the initial condition occurs at the end of time. And the final condition, really, that we're going to employ says that when the time window ends, the facility is not worth anything. Now, that's an arbitrary thing to assume, and you might imagine you'd rather have like a rental car, final condition, which would be you have to return the facility full to the person you leased it from. Otherwise, you have to pay a penalty. And that's something else you could do, but it's not what we did. Then you got to put in some boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions we put in, if you unpack these a little bit, the way I think of these isn't that the second derivative of V is with P is zero at large and small prices, but that the first partial derivative of V with P is constant, not necessarily the same constant, but it's constant for large and little prices. And the intuition there is when the price is really high or really low, making it a little higher or a little lower just has a linear effect in price on the value function. And if you think about that for, a few minutes, it'll make sense. And if you want more color on it, again, you can email me for the paper. Okay, so it turns out that's enough to actually solve this problem. Clearly, there's no way you're going to solve this problem analytically. And if we look at it, we see it looks like, so far it's looking like a diffusion equation with a bit of drift. But then we got this, then we have a partial derivative with I alone, and no second partial derivative of V with I, and that bothers us because that's like a hyperbolic term in the partial differential equation instead of a nice parabolic term like that. Okay? And that hyperbolic nature in I is reminiscent of the sort of gas dynamics problems where shock waves occur and not that shock waves do occur here, but where information travels only one direction, either, you know, in this case it travels from the boundaries. We had a boundary condition at I max and at I min, and the information comes from both those boundaries up and down. And because of that, we have to use the same kind of numerical techniques you use for gas dynamics problems, namely upwind finite differencing, or the generalization of those, which are these total variation diminishing schemes. And in this case, a scheme that works well turns out to be a slope limiter. Okay, so that was what these techniques were used to get the graphs I'm about to show you. A master's student, Rizwan Mukadam, redid all the numerics here using a completely different technique called the method of lines, numerical method of lines, and he got the same result. So we're confident that the numerics here are correct. Okay. So conscious of the fact that time is running a bit short, I'm just going to tell you that we picked sort of reasonable parameters for a particular facility called the Stratton Ridge gas storage facility. And the details of that aren't really that important. They led to a particular partial differential equation of the form I just showed you, but that's with all the sort of gory details put in. But really, what I really want to show you is the actual value, the control strategy here. And so what does the control strategy that gets spit out tell you? It tells you that when the facility is empty, right, this axis here, so let me just orient you to the axes. This is how much gas you have stored already, over and above the base gas, right? Remember, you needed to have a certain amount of gas, but we're not worrying about that. This is over and above that minimum amount of gas. And it's full at 2,000 and empty at zero, or effectively empty at zero. And here's the price of gas, which goes up that way. And here's the control strategy. And remember, when C was positive, we were releasing gas from the facility. When C was negative, we were pumping gas into the facility. So this has the right kind of intuitive properties. It says that when your facility is empty and gas is cheap, guess what? You should pump gas into that facility as soon as hard as you can. The reason why this thing curves, while you're pumping it harder here than here, even though the price is still zero for gas, which would never happen, but if it did, is because you can pump it harder when it's empty than when it's full, because the balloon is empty and therefore there's no pressure to fight against. Okay? That's the sort of engineering we put into this model. It doesn't really change anything until the price hits a certain threshold, at which point for a little while you just kind of do nothing. You neither pump nor release gas for a little window in the middle. And then when the price gets high and you're empty, you can't do anything. When the price gets high and you have a little bit of gas, if the price is really ridiculously high, and remember this is all based on old gas data where $12 was ridiculously high for gas, it's no longer the case. So that would mean the whole model would have to be recalibrated now. You'd end up with a different quantitative answer, but it would be of exactly the same qualitative form. It would, you know, everything would just be shifted over. Okay, and here you're going to be releasing as fast as you can as well. All right. The control strategy is the interesting 3D curve here. But just to say we were there, there's the value of the facility. I don't think, I can't even really see much from this, except I like to have lots of gas in storage rather than none. Yeah, kind of duh, right? And I like to have expensive gas rather than cheap gas to have a valuable facility. Okay, so that's so far so good. But what I like to do with this is take slices through it. And then we get some nice insights. So what are the slices here? I'm taking slices with a particular fill level. Okay, so if you go back here, it's like the I'm taking slices this way. Yeah, so I'm filling it to a certain level, and then I'm letting price vary, and I'm seeing how the value goes. So these are the curves I get, just by making those cuts. And that reminds me of puts and calls, and because this isn't necessarily a financial math audience, I'm going to just quickly remind you or tell you what a put and a call is. A put is a financial security that allows you to sell something at a fixed price, whereas a call is a financial security which allows you to buy something at a fixed price. Then there's lots of detail that you can layer on top of that, but that's all we need to know. Okay, so when the facility is empty, this thing looks like a put. It says, when the facility is empty, I have value in being able to buy the gas for zero. And if you like sell it into my facility, and this isn't really happening, I'm not really selling it, but I'm thinking of the value of gas stored in my facility is, in fact, about $5 per million BTUs. As it turns out, that's not something I put in, that's something that came out of the model. But it's the mean price to which it reverts, so I did sort of put it in. When it's totally full, then it looks more like a call. When the price gets really high, I can sell gas out of my storage into the market. And the value of that in the facility is not, the facility is worth more and more and more as the gas price goes up. In the middle, when we're sort of, half empty, half full, I've got some, when it's more empty than full, but it's not empty or full, right? It's sort of on the bottom end of the middle. It looks more like a put, but it looks a little like a call. And when it's a little bit, it's in fact exactly halfway full, it looks kind of equally like a put and a call. All right? So this is not perhaps surprising when you think about it, but it's nice to see it coming right out of the analysis. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say for now about natural gas storage. Next I want to talk about pump storage. So now we're back to electricity. Okay, and I have to make a proviso here, which is that the models I'm about to show you about electricity use the same kind of mean reversion, volatility, and jumps, stochastic formulation for electricity spot as we use for gas spot. I do not believe that's a good model for electricity spot, but it's a model that allows us to formulate and solve the problem as a continuous problem, which means we can wheel in all kinds of powerful numerical tools. I think there are better ways of modeling spot price, and as I said, my colleague Lindsay Anderson has done an awful lot of work on doing that. It's just that it's more difficult to do the optimization with those models. That's something that we'd like to rectify at some point. This goes to what Peter was talking about with load shape. There's a low demand for power in the middle of the night, and there's a high demand for electricity, in the middle of the afternoon, say, and when it's hot in the summer. And what you'd really like to do is to as a utility, is to be able to store power from the middle of the night and release it in the middle of the day. But since you can't store electricity, that's not going to work too well. So you have to find some other ways around it. But we talked about how inelastic people's demand for electricity is. An anecdote that goes to that is, remember after that big blackout, they were basically praying on TV saying, please don't run your air conditioner, because if you do, the whole system's might come down again, and then, you know, sick babies are going to have a problem tonight. And then the reporters went around and they saw people were still cranking up their air conditioner at 100%. They didn't care. They didn't care when it was kind of almost like an emergency. They're sure not going to care if it's a couple of dollars or a couple of pennies. Okay, so how can you possibly store electricity? Well, one way to do it is to pump water up a hill, put it in a reservoir, wait, and then pump it down the hill later. It turns out you can do that with about an 80% round-trip efficiency. And such facilities do exist. One facility exists in Michigan on the sort of mirror image of the Niagara Escarpment from here. There's also one in Wales that I know of and one in Switzerland that I know of. But these are all sort of legacy systems that I think were built for more system reasons and not necessarily as a profit-making venture, right? Okay, so that's the idea. What's the best way of doing this? Turns out we can write down a PDE for this as well. That's how these things look. If anyone's interested in the details of this or the details of the thermal power plant that I probably won't talk about much today, the thermal power plant optimization that can also be done, we have a paper that people are welcome to either go check out or contact me for a copy of. Okay, so it's essentially exactly the same idea as the idea I showed you for gas. I'm not going to go through all the gory details again. The engineering is different, a little different, although it's still fluid mechanics. And if you put it all together, you end up with that ugly looking PIDE. And here you actually see your normal distribution of jumps explicitly. And you get here, for whatever reason, I decided to show the value surface first, and it tells you about as little here as it did before, except that you like to have lots of water stored. Head is how much water you have stored, rather than little. And you like to have high prices rather than low prices. The more interesting thing here is the control strategy, which is a bit like before. If your facility is empty and the price is low, you pump. If the facility is full and the price is high, you release water. There's a constraint coming into play here, which is why this thing sort of truncates. And in the middle, remember, it's 80% efficient round trip, so you're not going to do anything if you don't expect to be able to make at least 25% more on the power that you put in, right? Just to overcome the dead weight efficiency losses, and that's what you're seeing here. So this is another control of a kind of bang-bang type, really. It's not just discrete levels it's banging between because of the engineering constraints on the system, but it's of that form. Okay. I actually don't need to tell you much about all the gory details of thermal plants because Peter already did, and he mentioned a few that I didn't mention here. But lo and behold, you can run this same kind of idea with thermal plants too. And if you do, you get a PDE with an integral term. And now you get a control strategy, which I'm not really going to talk about because we're almost out of time, and I want to have a few minutes just to briefly talk about some other things. And a value surface, which does all the things you expect it to do. All right. So future work along this line of attack. One important thing that we weren't able to do with the thermal plant in the paper that I referred you to is to incorporate minimum realistic minimum downtime constraints into the model. Matt has now figured out a way of doing this, and the paper is sort of shuttling back and forth to referees, as I understand, but it's his paper. And maybe I'll write his email down, too, in case anybody wants to I think this is what it is. business.queensu.ca. For those going to Montreal next week, he'll be talking to Montreal as well. I mentioned this sort of model of Lindsay Anderson's, that we believe is a more realistic electricity spot price model that is based on a stack, if you like, and on some failure modeling. It would be nice to use that for the electricity optimal control rather than the continuous model. And then there's some other things that would be nice to look at. Just one last slide. It would be nice to look at optimizing hydroelectric plants where the water inflows were random, unlike the pump storage where we were doing all the water flows. A hydroelectric plant where the power flow was coming from an actual watershed. And if you're going to do that, you actually end up without a Markov process. The idea being that if it rains really hard, if it rains really hard up north of here, you know that the Humber River is going to be full, not at exactly the same time that it's raining, but a few days later to give time for the water to make it down the river, right? And that water can take a number of different paths down the river, a direct path, going in and out of wetlands, going in and out of groundwater, and the effect of all that is effectively to make a convolution integral between a random input function and a sort of response function that deals with all that different geography. And one way to look at that is something called fractional Brownian motion, which seems to work well for modeling these things. I'm not going to talk about that. And I'm not going to talk about wind power either. I'd rather leave a few minutes for some questions and have us done at our contracted time. Okay. Thank you.